Okay, let's go into Mike's case.
Okay, this patient is really a delightful 57-year-old woman police officer who was admitted to the hospital in early January with bowel obstruction. A colonoscopy demonstrated a tumor at 35 centimeters. CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis did not demonstrate any evidence of metastatic disease. Chest x-ray was also clear. Pre-op CEA level was 10.7. The patient underwent a left hemicolectomy with a temporary left-sided colostomy. The tumor was resected in total. There was no evidence of intra-abdominal spread. Pathology demonstrated a moderately well-differentiated adenocarcinoma extending to the fat with negative margins and 3 of 65 lymph nodes involved. Postoperatively, the CEA normalized, and she came to see me in February of this year, and she was initiated on adjuvant chemotherapy with FOLFOX6, received 9 cycles of treatment, and actually would come on Fridays after work, had virtually no toxicity to speak of. And after the 9th cycle, she came on a Friday that she wasn't supposed to be there, the off Friday, thinking that she was supposed to be there for treatment. And to all of us who knew her, seemed a little confused, although when you pressed her, she seemed to know, oh, my mistake, but did actually a little mini sobriety test on her, had her walk a straight line, and she was okay, but she did have a low-grade fever. We drew blood cultures. We sent her home, and less than 12 hours later, she was admitted through the emergency room with seizures, high-grade fever, and markedly confused. An MRI of the brain was performed, and it showed bitemporal enhancement suggestive of a herpes encephalitis. And an LP was performed. There was 100 cells, almost all lymphocytes, and by PCR, it was confirmed to be herpetic. It was HSV-2. Fortunately, she was placed on a high dose of cyclovir, and gradually over about a 10-day period has come back to just about normal and left the hospital about 4 days ago.
What do we know about herpes encephalitis and chemotherapy?
You know, I just tried to jog my memory. I had a patient with herpes encephalitis on chemotherapy years ago. And I cannot even remember which patient, what kind of disease it was, whether it was this patient was treated with significant myelosuppressive agents. That's a question that I would have for you, whether there was significant leukopenia in between these events. And so I would say it's not unheard of. The second case that I more or less, one myself and one now presented by you. But I mean, herpes encephalitis occurs. I mean, this is nothing that is completely out of the equation in all instances. But it's not one of those side effects I would normally associate with treatment of colon cancer.
Are you going to continue therapy?
Well, so that's really the big issue for me right now. She would become asymptomatically neutropenic around 1,000 between cycles, but never had a treatment delay. She's had 9 cycles of good adjuvant treatment, 3 positive nodes. Do I risk it and treat her to completion?
No. No. Very much no. So first of all, you delayed chemotherapy anyway. I mean, you're probably out of a window of several weeks now. Secondly, the discussion that we're having right now in our scientific community, how long do we really need to treat a patient with FOLFOX? And I'm giving you several issues to that. First of all, the dose intensity of oxaliplatin in MOSAIC, which is the trial that led to the approval of FOLFOX in the adjuvant setting, eventually the dose intensity was 81%. So instead of 1,020 milligrams per meter squared, patient received something around 800 somewhat milligrams per meter squared, which is equivalent to about 10 cycles of therapy. Secondly, the CO7 data from NSAVP-CO7, they used a lower target dose anyway. This target dose was 765 milligrams per meter squared, which is equivalent to about 9 cycles of therapy. So in the end, you already have data that showed even with a lower dose of oxaliplatin based there, and we think, you know, this probably applies to 5-FU in a similar way because dose intensity of 5-FU was not 100% in all these trials. And even in CO7 now, these targeted 765 milligrams per meter squared were not reached because the dose intensity there was about 85%. So we're now shifting lower to about 700 milligrams. And there is an international endeavor right now emerging, which will test the question, can we get away with 3 months of FOLFOX compared to 6 months? And it's easy to see for a non-inferiority trial, because you don't want to harm patients, you don't want to take efficacy away from patients, you need a large number of patients. I mean, we're probably looking at 10,000 patient trials. This cannot be done in the United States. So on the other hand, the question is important. If we can get away with 3 months of treatment, that's important for patients, talking about neurotoxicity, talking about convenience, talking about impairment of quality of life, etc. So what's happening right now as we speak is an international endeavor, the so-called IDEA trial or IDEA analysis, which is the International Duration Evaluation of Adjuvant Therapy, with a trial coordinated between Italy, they already have a trial ongoing, Scotland, Jim Cassidy's trial, the German AIO, and the CLGB most likely. So we'll have four trials. Each of them will accrue about 2,000 to 3,000 patients and will prospectively pool these patients into a 10,000 to 12,000 patient analysis, 3 versus 6 months of therapy.
Probably that'll be a trial that won't be hard to accrue because it's sort of a simple question, but nobody's going to get cured, right? And the cure rate's not going to increase because of it. I know these docs were very, a lot of them were putting patients on the CA08 FOLFOX BEV study.
Yeah.
What are some of the next research questions? This lady, maybe if there had been a trial available, or might have been interested.
I mean, there's a trial ongoing right now on hold for this very moment, which tests cetuximab in KRAS wild-type tumor. So that's an NCTG-led trial, N147, which tests the question whether cetuximab can play a role as adjunct to FOLFOX, now in an amended version, only in patients with KRAS wild-type tumors. This trial will hopefully be open again and will accrue for another half year, and then we'll have 3,200 patients. And we'll be able to answer the question whether cetuximab plays a role in the adjuvant setting in KRAS wild-type tumors. This is mirrored by a European trial, the PETAC-A trial, very similar approach. So we'll have enough data to really show what's going on. Then CO8 tested bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting. Of course, very interesting. Then we heard data on, like what Charlie Fuchs presented in vitamin D, celecoxib. This is one of the proposals that just went to the GI steering committee. So we'll see what happens. I haven't seen the official verdict on this trial idea. There's a European trial by the ERTC which uses a Sanofi Aventis vaccine, or that's planned to use a vaccine against colon cancer in the adjuvant setting after treatment with FOLFOX. So I think these are the ideas that are floating around there. It's not this one new agent right now that I could tell you, okay, this is the drug that we need to test, or the combination of antibodies, cetuximab, panitumumab plus bevacizumab, would not be tested in the adjuvant setting right now based on the detrimental effect we saw in first-line setting in colon cancer.
Oh. My partners have been emailing me just recently about the lack of an active adjuvant colon study because we accrued very well to CO8, and my partners are all upset that they think that the colon cancer doctors are, not to be critical of the academics, are moving way too slow with this as opposed to breast cancer. I mean, we almost never have a time in breast cancer where there's no national adjuvant trial open for months and months and months and months. I mean, that would, people would get hanged in the breast cancer community if that was happening. But so I just wonder, can't we get some of these vaccine things or some of these things and just move them up and start doing them now rather than wait another year with all the patients in the country just receiving FOLFOX, not on a study?
Yeah. So again, the one study that's going to be reopened very soon is the cetuximab study.
How would they feel about that one?
I think they would be interested, especially if it's an enriched population now and we have scientific data that the rash is potentially really worth it for that. They were not as enthusiastic as they were about CO8, I don't think.
So with the enriched population, I would think this drug actually has a much higher chance
right.
to be effective because, again, when we talk about the 24% increase in response rate in the palliative setting, if this holds up in the adjuvant setting, it would be really nice that we might be able to cure.
That will motivate the patients too, I think.
Yeah.
If you say this test has been done and you look like you're in the group board.
Yeah. This test, KRAS, has really changed the way we look at colon cancer and it has created a different mindset. Hopefully, this is the first step for a lot of new biomarkers to come which will influence our treatment decision. Oncology will be more complicated in the future. I mean, we're seeing breast cancer is already many different diseases, so lung cancer is turning into different diseases and colon cancer is turning into different diseases. So all these biomarkers will make it more individualized, more complicated. So this trial will open and we'll probably have this trial around for another 9 months after. So, but I agree, we need new trial ideas, we need new trials. And unfortunately, there's, again, not this one new drug in colon cancer. So that's why we're exploring things like vitamin D, celecoxib. Having said that, the Victor trial with rofecoxib, which was cut short as a UK trial, did not show really, let's say, earth-shattering results at ASCO this year, but it was cut short and all these problems surrounding COX-2 inhibitors came into play there. But we will have a new trial up and running within a year from now. Then there is, in stage two, there is ECOG-E5202. In rectal cancer, we have trials that are ongoing. So I think we're just lacking a trial right now in stage three colon cancer, which is stopped right now, which will be reopened. And then, of course, we'll lack a trial in KRAS mutant tumors, stage three, because N0147 will not address those patients anymore.
And then there's always my favorite, which is diet and exercise, which is never going to get done probably. But I mean, Charlie Fuchs, they have interesting data on diet and exercise. In breast, we have diet and exercise. I don't see any trials.
Almost all patients ask, so what else can I do? I mean, that's one of the most common questions that I receive. And I said, yes, then I bring it up. I said, okay, this is something you can, there's data that you can influence your risk of recurrence by exercise and diet, perhaps by vitamin D. And I said, you know, a lot of these issues, you know, exercise and diet, it's not like, oh, wow, I never thought of that. This is something we should do anyway. So these are lifestyle things that we should all take into account.
One of the biggest questions is what to do with a patient who has stage 2 disease.
Okay, very straightforward what I do. Okay, stage 2 disease, first of all, I look for risk factors, for clinical risk factors, meaning perforation, undifferentiated tumor, low number of lymph nodes resected. Your patient had actually a very nice number of lymph nodes resected. 3 were positive.
Low so is less than 10 or less than 12?
Less than 12 for me. Less than 12 for me. Of course, we all have to take this with some grain of salt. I mean, the overall prognosis of a patient with 11 compared to 12 lymph nodes, it's not that different. But at some point, you have to have a convention. You make a decision and you say, okay, this is what we use. A lymphovascular invasion. We talked perforation obstruction. So these clinical risk factors, which we get from the chart, from the path report, from the surgical report, clinical presentation, and no fancy molecular biology can guide us in saying, yes, this patient needs chemotherapy. And I assume this patient is fit for chemotherapy. So we're talking about the patient who is fit for chemotherapy. So then we're talking about fluoropyrimidine alone or oxaliplatin use. So the data that we have from Mosaic show there is a significant or there is an interesting risk reduction for disease recurrence, disease free survival increase, in patients with high-risk stage 2 cancers, as per definition that we just said, when you use FOLFOX compared to 5-FU. We've not yet seen data whether this group, high-risk stage 2, has better overall survival. But the study was, we're talking about subgroup of a subgroup. We're talking about subgroup of this trial and then a subgroup. So from my perspective, because I think that prolonging disease-free survival, keeping the patient free from tumor, has a value in itself, I use oxaliplatin-based therapy in these high-risk stage 2 patients. Okay, now we're talking about non-high-risk stage 2. In non-high-risk stage 2, according to these clinical criteria, we have no data at all that oxaliplatin is helpful. So now we go back to any Cromer stage 2 patients, and we have the data from the QUASAR trial that showed 5-FU is better than nothing. So now you're no longer questioning yourself, should I use oxaliplatin or 5-FU? You're questioning yourself, should I use 5-FU or nothing? And then, most recently, we have data from Dansargent's analysis about the mismatch repair enzymes, which is more or less microsatellite instability analysis. Those patients who have microsatellite instability, MSI high or defective mismatch repair enzymes, has a kind of familial syndrome that's Lynch, this HMPCC, but we're talking about tumor, not necessarily germline mutations. Those patients with DMMR, defective mismatch repair, have no benefit from 5-FU. They might actually get harm from 5-FU. So if I have my cascade of treatment decisions, I look at stage 2, risk factor, high risk, FOLFOX. No risk factor, I use MSI, MSI stable tumors, capecitabine, which is my preferred fluoropyrimidine, MSI instable tumors, no treatment at all.
What about age? What if the patient's 36? Does that influence you?
Good question. When you now look at the, it's something that I've done one way or the other. If you look at the potential increase of, let's say, efficacy that you have with oxaliplatin compared to 5-FU, and this is probably your question where you go at, in pure stage 2 disease, it's really minimal, if at all. And I do strongly believe that stage 2 disease and stage 3 disease are two different diseases. This is not like there's a biologic difference whether a tumor can create lymph node metastasis or not. Michael Connell last year presented very interesting data on, you look at patients with stage 2 disease and stage 3 disease as diagnosis, and eventually they develop metastasis. The overall outcome of these metastases, the prognosis of patients, went back to kind of, was clearly dependent on whether patients were initially diagnosed stage 2 or stage 3 disease. So tumors that eventually present at stage 4 were much better when they were initially stage 2 than if they were initially stage 3. So what is happening? These tumors are different. The difference was actually profound, larger different than we ever obtained with chemotherapy.
And that's very different than breast cancer because there's no analogy there.
Yeah.
That description you just gave is very different than the description researchers give in breast cancer. Of course, there's like a lot more data in breast cancer. There's tons of data in node-negative disease. I'm not sure we really have enough data right now. Only have the MOSAIC trial is the only trial.
This is a data analysis based on 20,000 patients.
I'm talking about the issue of whether does Oxali, for example, help in stage 2. Breast cancer, they have a concept of relative risk reduction. If you get a benefit, you just apply it going down.
It's a good question. We only have MOSAIC data, and we have the CO7 data, which Noam Wallmark is very reluctant to kind of tease out of stage 2 and stage 3, and he kind of brushes over things a lot. He did actually present a forest plot of CO7. And you saw that for stage 3 disease, the effect on disease-free and overall survival was very strong in the positive area for this FLOX therapy. For stage 2 disease, the effect was on the other side of the median bar. So there was no effect on stage 2 disease in CO7. So you have two trials now. You saw cumulative data of about 4,000 patients. Not as solid as, of course, breast cancer data, etc. But you have two very well-conducted trials with both show that oxaliplatin doesn't play any role in outcome in average risk stage 2 disease.
So do you use capecitabine then?
I use capecitabine.
What exactly is going on when you someone has 8 or 9 lymph nodes taken out and they're all negative? Is it that the thought is that there's other lymph nodes with cancer that are left behind?
You know,
I mean, it's hard to understand that.
Yeah. So first of all,
unfound by the pathologist that they're actually there.
Yeah. So when I have this case in at Mayo Clinic, we do see that. Actually, I've seen it twice now. I got a report, 10 lymph nodes negative. So I called the pathologist and I said, "Do you know what this implies?" I mean, and the pathologists are not always aware of that. I mean, if you find 2 more lymph nodes, I do not have to subject this patient to 6 months of chemotherapy. And he said, "Oh my God," you know. And so a day later, I had a report, addendum amended report, 12 lymph nodes negative. So, I mean, my first reaction is call the pathologist. Having said that, I mean, Nancy Baxter had an interesting paper about 2 years ago looking at outcomes in patients who had kind of which outcome correlated to the number of lymph nodes identified, even beyond the 12 lymph nodes mark. So the more lymph nodes there are, the better outcome is. So could this tie into with some immunologic response? We know about lymphocytic infiltration around tumors is a better prognostic marker than no lymphocytic infiltration. Is this something that kind of highlights the reactivity of patients against their tumor and whatever mechanism you might imply? I don't know. And this is one of the most common question and actually kind of a twist in our thoughts that you just bring up. My idea would be this is along the lines of reactivity of our organism against the tumor. More easy to find lymph nodes.
I guess just to present a couple balancing points. First of all, I think it was last year, they presented data showing that the incidence of less than 12 positive nodes in the NCCN hospitals was like 11% versus 50% in SEER.
Yeah.
So part of this may be how hard people are looking for them. Malik?
Do you check microsatellite on all stage 2 patients? What about stage 3? It does not matter?
Yes. You do check it for those patients.
Loris.
Where you make a decision, should I treat this patient with fluoropyrimidines? Oxaliplatin apparently can overrule this resistance to fluoropyrimidine in MSI-high tumors, and there is some preclinical data on that. So our treatment algorithm is, okay, if you have a decision, fluoropyrimidine single agent, capecitabine, 5-FU, or not, this is where we test for a defective mismatch repair, which is, for most purposes, you capture 95% of these patients with immunohistochemistry if you just stain for these mismatch repair enzymes. And so I do think this is practical, and it's actually quite worthwhile in clinical practice. Based on the data that Dan Sargent showed in this meta-analysis, pooled analysis of all available data so far, all biospecimens that are available so far, showing that patients who have this defective mismatch repair enzyme constellation actually have an adverse outcome, decreased overall survival when they're treated with 5-FU.